My ambition after that trip to the Highlands was simply to see if Tasmania could make a really good single malt whisky.
We don't expect everyone to like these wines, so yes, there's some risk.
Drink more sherry, because that's when you can really educate yourself on what happens in maturation.
The thing is with Australian natives, you put them in a gin, the aftertaste invariably is just bitter and unpalatable.
I think the Irish whisky landscape is going to be wildly different over the next 5 years.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits, and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today.
I tend not to talk too much about myself on this show because nothing annoys me more than a podcast host who doesn't let their guests get a word in. But after almost 5 years and coming up to 200 episodes, perhaps it's time for you to hear a little bit more about me, how I started Drinks Adventures, and where it might be headed. Recently, Andrew Graham from Caddy, the wholesale beverage marketplace, asked to interview me for its industry news pages, Caddy Community. To which I said, sure, but if we're going to do it, we may as well record the interview properly so I can share it with you, my Drinks Adventures listeners. So here it is, an edited version of that interview, with Andrew asking me the questions for a change. I hope you enjoy the chat.
Okay. Let's have the James Atkinson origin story. Like, how did you get into booze in the first place?
Well, I guess going right back, I studied broadcast journalism at uni, so that was like graduating in 99 and didn't really have a clear idea of what I wanted to do with that qualification. And yeah, the first 10 years or so that I did were very eclectic, I guess you could say. Like, I was very into music. When I finished uni, I did a lot of freelance music writing for different magazines, and just because I was enjoying it. You know, a lot of sort of trade press stuff, different business publications along the way, some kind of more mainstream news as well. Like, you know, when 2UE had the owner of 2UE had like an internet portal that they started called My Talk, I worked on that. You know, I lived in the UK for a while and I did Virgin Media, another sort of internet portal. They used to call them portals. I don't think they use that word anymore. It's kind of such a like early, you know, .com kind of term, isn't
still
it?
Still around.
Yeah. And then, you know, when the sort of the whole booze thing kind of came about. I mean, I guess I'd always really enjoyed a nice beer, and travelling around Europe kind of came to appreciate that the beer that I was drinking there was a lot better than what I would find on tap in Australia going back, you know, at that time. And I was looking for a job when I came back from London, and the job as editor of The Shout yes. came up. And it sort of seemed like a perfect role for me in a way, because I sort of had that business journalism background. The Shout is partly sort of a business publication, as you know, and kind of reporting on what all the ASX listed companies are doing and mm-hmm. industry news for very much a trade audience of buyers like publicans and retailers. And so I sort of had that business reporting background and enjoyed a tipple. All of a sudden, you know, as you would well know, I'm getting invited to all these amazing events.
That's right.
Very social, fun industry.
Absolutely.
Made a lot of good friends, had a great time, and also just became quite interested in the business of the industry and went deeper on drinks, you know, and found that I was getting exposed to the best of the best of every category. And I feel like it just kept opening me up more and more and more. And I've never been someone who just wants to say, okay, well, I'm just going to do beer or I'm just going to do wine. I've kept myself across everything the whole way through. And I think that's been a double-edged sword in terms of the path that I've been on. I think in some ways it's been harder because of that. But then in other ways, I think I'm sort of doing something different to everyone else. So, you know, like my niche is that I don't have a niche, if that makes sense. So, yeah, that's kind of the evolution. And, you know, as you know, I suppose, like since The Shout, it was Matt Kierkegaard from Brews News who approached me, and I went and worked with him on that for a few years and went kind of really deep into the beer and brewing industry, and was doing a lot of other freelance writing on the side. And then when decided to part ways with Matt eventually, that was when I just sort of was really, really interested in the podcast space and looking and going, oh, there's not really anything there that's covering the whole world of drinks. there were a lot of brewing podcasts, like a lot of beer podcasts, but most of them were two guys talking about what they're drinking. And there were a lot of those.
Yes.
And there were some great beer podcasts as well, obviously, like Radio Brews News and a few others. There's really not much else out there in wine and spirits. I just thought, you know, why don't I do something that just covers the whole world of drinks with the kind of ethos of, I sort of say to people, well, if someone said to you, oh, I only like Chinese food, you know, for example,
sure,
you would think that was weird. Like, you know, you were, and that's like people who are like, I only like beer, or I'm only interested in wine. And I mean, wine, I love taking the piss out of it, but I feel like people who are really into fine wine, they don't even know there are any other beverages out there. It's like wine is just on this echelon above everything else, and there's no complexity or anything else worth exploring beneath wine, you know what I mean? And so, yeah, that's sort of the path that I guess I've been on, and now Drinks Adventures, 5 years now, 170 episodes or something like that.
Do you look back at those, like at those original podcasts, and cringe now?
Yeah, I do, because the audio was not.
Yeah.
I actually think that, you know, it wasn't too bad compared to a lot of the stuff that people put out there.
Absolutely.
Because the biggest problem with podcasting, I mean, it's a good and a bad thing, is that there's no barriers to entry. I mean, you and I could, anyone can record something on their phone and put it on the internet within a few hours and say they've got a podcast. It's very easy to do that. But to make a good one is a lot more difficult. And I feel like because I sort of did have some radio experience and I, you know, I was a journalist, I had some sort of idea about what I was doing, but I didn't. The gear that I had was shit, and it was cheap, and I didn't have an awareness of recording environments, of where to record, and, you know, there's, like, definitely the worst audio quality I've ever done, and it was such a great interview, so it's kind of a shame. Yeah, it was Janice McDonald.
Who you re-interviewed just the other way, just recently?
Yeah, who's back on the show. Uh-huh. And, yeah, I was trying to find a place to do it, and I did it at Staves with her in Glebe, and they had, like, you know, their glycol system. Right? So there's just this whir in the background. It's deafening. But in saying that, you can still hear everything we're saying.
Yes.
So it's completely audible. And, you know, I never, from the start, I've kind of always been quite particular about audio, even when I didn't have the equipment to help me. Like, I sort of had the awareness to say, well, if this is going to be something that's so bad that I have to apologise to my listeners about it, then it's probably something that I just shouldn't put to air.
Absolutely. So can you talk us through the setup now, as far as if you're going to record? You know, I guess you're often on location trying to record on location, otherwise you're here in the studio. So what's your setup? Obviously you try and record, and then do you have production afterwards as well?
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny how the whole thing's just evolved, because going back prior to COVID, every interview that I did was face-to-face. I don't think I did anything online at all. And that was a standard that I kind of wanted to keep to differentiate myself, I suppose, versus a lot of the crappy Skype quality audio that you hear on podcasts. And, you know, back in the before times, before I had a baby and before COVID, I was traveling around a lot, and I was going overseas, and I was out there doing stuff where I was going to get access to awesome people to get on the podcast. And then COVID happened, and very quickly it was like, oh, okay, well, if I'm going to be trying to do interviews face to face, then this is not really going to work anymore.
Absolutely.
And so I just had to very quickly sort of upskill myself with how to record online, which I do now. Now I'd say 90% of the interviews that I do are recorded online, because A, I don't have the time and to be running around, and I'm not traveling like I used to. And B, you can just get access to much better people then, you know. And that was the other thing during COVID. It's like, well, you know, I can probably ask anyone to be on the podcast now, and they're probably going to be at home.
That's exactly right.
You know, like
access.
Sam Neill's isolating in Sydney. I'll get him on the show. You know, Maynard Keenan from Tool, he's not touring at the moment. So, yeah, I started getting some great interviews that probably helped. You know, things have just kind of snowballed with getting great guests on ever since some of those big names that have been on the show. And so, yeah, I suppose I record mostly online. Occasionally I have interviews in here. It's a bit of a makeshift, to be honest. You know, I've got a good microphone. That lapel mic that you've got on is a high-quality microphone, but this is not a proper studio. It's just been cobbled together a little bit, and it's good enough to get fantastic audio for a podcast. one day, if I'm more solvent than I am now, then I'll be. I'd love to sort of fit out a studio properly so that you could just walk into it and it was treated and it sounded absolutely amazing. And I'm not kind of constantly moving shit around, sort of having this as a desk as well as a studio. So yeah.
Okay, that's a good question, actually, though. Like, how do you make this work financially? Because that's always the biggest challenge as far as anyone who's trying to do podcasting is about how to actually make it work. Because there's lots of people out there who you say you're at the amateur level and it's just often it's a bunch of dudes having a conversation. But to actually take it to the next level and to make it a livelihood, like, how do you do that?
Well, I mean, there's no rules like with podcasting. There is no textbook of how to do things. And I think everyone's monetizing their podcast in sort of different ways. And for me, before COVID, it sort of started like a sideline to the freelance writing that I was doing, which was both journalism but also copywriting for clients as well. The first season that I did, I just made it completely off my own back. And, you know, I remember that, like, that was sort of August, September, and I spent so much time doing it. And by the end of that 8 weeks, I was like, shit, I better try and make some money because I'm actually broke at the moment because I just spent so much time on it. And the first season, I did like 3 documentary style episodes that had a lot of interviews and a lot of production work involved. I was being, I suppose, overambitious with what I was trying to do with it because I just had creative things that I was interested in doing, and I'm glad that I did it, but it was really too much time to be spending on something that wasn't revenue generating. But then by the next year, I sort of I knew the guys at Bintani well, who supply ingredients to the brewing and distilling industries. I knew them from my time at Brews News, and I knew that they'd really expanded their business to be catering for the distilling industry. And so particularly there wasn't really any publications out there in distilling that were reaching that audience. And from day one, I've had a really good trade audience of producers from the distilling industry, as well as brewers as well, I think. And so, yeah, Bintani came on board and supported it early on with sort of a basic sponsorship package. And Fever Tree came on soon after that. They're both a great fit for what I'm doing, really. And Fever Tree because, well, I wouldn't really want to have a whiskey brand or a gin brand sponsor the show because it would just taint it for all the other companies that I want to get on the show. And Fever Tree is obviously perfect because it's a mixer brand. There's not many other mixer brands of that sort of quality. And it's a great platform for them to reach people who are gin or whiskey or rum or whatever enthusiasts. And so I sort of had those two sponsors. And then when COVID happened, I flipped everything. I lost a lot of my other work. I was on JobKeeper like a lot of people were for about a year and started working on, okay, well, I might put a newsletter out and start focusing on commercializing this because if publishers can turn around to me and sort of say, oh, well, sorry, we've got no more work for you, then at least if I'm my own boss, at least I'm going to know what the decisions are and what the situation is that I'm in to, you know, sort of make decisions myself. So it's all just been kind of organically the way that it's evolved. I never started and said, I want to start a podcasting business. It's just evolved. And I've got to be honest, it's been incredibly challenging. Apart from the sponsorships that I have, which are great, the big kind of revenue driver that I have is the sponsored episodes, which is really just I produce them the same way that I do everything else. It's just that the production costs and my time are supported by the company that I'm partnering with to make the content. I manage to do them in such a way that it's not just advertorial that people aren't going to want to listen to. It's still great content. And so I've never had someone say, oh, there's too much sponsored content, and I make sure that I balance it with stuff that isn't as well. But ultimately, that's just the thing doesn't exist if it's not commercially viable, and so that's the way a lot of media has gone. And I think that I still, in those episodes, I still manage to ask some pretty difficult questions. And I think that the brands, the smart marketing managers that sort of understand that they're kind of getting the benefit of the authenticity of a real interview with a journalist who is not just going to give them a free ride. You know, it might be sponsored, but you can still do it in a way where it gives them that credibility that they, if they just got someone internal to do an interview, they wouldn't be able to create the same thing. They just wouldn't be able to. So that's sort of been the revenue model. I haven't gone down the Patreon route, which is what a lot of podcasters do. I might one day, but I have watched it pretty closely, and I think that it's only really viable if you're massive. You know, I mean, I'm an Arsenal football fan, or a lapsed one, even though I'm kind of starting to get more interested. I've been getting more interested in them this season. But, you know, there's a podcast that I listen to over there, and they have hundreds of thousands of pounds of Patreon revenue every year. And the fan base for Arsenal Football Club is just enormous, and they've got the best fan podcast. And so, of course, their audience is huge, and there's that so much passion around a football team like that. And that's where Patreon can work really, really well. But I think for something like what I'm doing, which is a lot more niche, albeit it is, I think, the leading podcast in the country for drinks and is growing and kind of getting towards some significant benchmarks for podcast listenership. But still, it's still sort of, I think, a long way off where the Patreon thing would be worth the trouble. You know, what I didn't want to do was, I think, like with Patreon, you've sort of got to have these benefits that you can offer people. And so you've got to kind of be creating extra content for them. And it's like my nightmare would be like having to create all this new content for 50 people, because it's actually just not, it's genuinely not worth it. So yeah, that's an avenue I might go down at some point, but not right now. Right now, I'm just kind of still focused on, I need more sponsorships really. And if you look at Drinks Adventures, I think there's a lot of potential there for different partners to work with, both on the trade and consumer side. At the end of so many episodes, I'm asking the brands that I work with, for example, where people can go to get it. And obviously, there's an opportunity there to slot in a plug to send someone to a retail partner. So all those conversations and stuff are being had, and it just takes a long time to sort of to meet the right people to get things to happen.
Do you have a like a hit list of people you'd like to interview?
Yeah, I do. And I've kind of nailed a lot of them down, to be honest. Dan Aykroyd was one I wanted to get for a while. I've been trying.
Spoke to him like twice, haven't you now? Once or twice?
Not on the podcast, okay. But once on the podcast. Yeah, Maynard, Sam Neill, Daniel Ricciardo coming out next week. I've just finished that. That's coming out on Tuesday, probably by the time this article comes out. I never want to take it down the direction of just it being a gimmicky celebrity-led thing. It's always got to be something where there's just a little bit more depth to the partnership to talk about. And I think in most of the cases, those cases that I've just mentioned, you know, we're talking about people who actually own the brand, and some of them even get their hands dirty in the winery or whatever it is, and can speak intimately about the liquid in the bottle. It's not just like they've put their name to something. You know, there's different levels to that. But, you know, even, yeah, Daniel, he's much more involved than just putting his name on it. And Ricky Ponting, he's a partner in the business. So, yeah, that's kind of a benchmark I want to kind of keep to. Yeah, I've got lots of people I'd like to speak to, but it's always a matter of like you're trying to keep that balance of covering all the different categories. And I don't know if I'll really get to the list of people that I have in my mind of that I would like to talk to, because, you know, some of the best conversations I think that I've had has been with people like yourself who are writers themselves, and maybe they've got a book out and then we talk about that book, or and sort of talk about, you know, people who've got, not necessarily producers, but people who've got opinions and can speak authoritatively on their chosen subject. Sometimes they're the best sorts of ones, and there's no limit to the number of great talent that there is out there to talk to, especially internationally. And, you know, like it's evolved into something that's much more international than it was when I started it. The international audience is kind of growing, I think, probably quicker than, you know, the Australian audience is still growing as well, really strongly, but it's growing in the US and the UK quite a lot, probably a little bit quicker, because it's coming off a smaller base and there's such bigger markets. And so if I'm talking to a Scotch whiskey distiller or champagne winemaker or whatever, chef de cave, then why wouldn't they want to listen to it if they're interested in that? It doesn't really matter that it's sort of an Australian title. So, yeah, so what I'm saying is the scope of what I'm doing is kind of so broad, and the potential guests are so broad. There's always a bit of a list ticking away, and, you know, in the back of my head, I haven't even really gotten to committing it to paper, because everything just kind of seems to, yeah, just kind of happen. I think I've kind of switched to batch producing a lot more than I used to, where I'll just have a couple of weeks where I'll just do a lot of interviews and have almost 6 months worth of content, because that's more efficient than constantly chasing your tail each week and having to find a guest on a weekly basis. It works much better just having all the content locked away. Yeah, I always like having a lot of content in the can and just feeling comfortable that I know what's coming up.
How do you, like, obviously there's going to be a way then to try and make podcasting and those conversations interesting, because there's plenty of people out there who have podcasts where it could just feel like a rambling conversation. Like, how do you sort of draw out the things that might be interesting as opposed to it evolving into something rambling? Like, how do you keep that tight when it comes to these podcasts and episodes?
It can be hard depending on the guest, but there's sort of two sides to that, I guess. One is I'm just like a naturally curious and sort of nosy person. I like kind of looking under the hood and seeing how things work and sort of asking the questions about the things that interest me, really. I'm pretty selective about the guests that I have on in the first place. I try and generally know whether they're going to be articulate and good, what sort of journos call good talent, you know what I mean? Like they can speak well and they're good in an interview. But then you still end up doing a lot of interviews that can end up quite waffly and can go on for too long, and that's when the editing comes in. And I think that that's part of the discipline with podcasting, is kind of knowing what not to put in the episode. And it's not uncommon for me to take an episode that's 45, 50 minutes long and cut it down to 20 minutes. There has to be a logical narrative flow, even if it's just an interview, it has to make sense, like where it starts and where it finishes, if you know what I mean. Like the note that it ends on can't be something completely, I don't know, you can't kind of leave people hanging going, what, you know. So you often, it might mean moving questions around and restructuring the interview. If you need to, you can drop in a bit of voiceover here and there to kind of, that's something that I didn't do very early on. I, you know, it was like if I wanted to change things around, I was a bit limited because I wasn't doing things like dropping in some voiceover if I needed to. So it's partly about all of the setup for the interview and choosing the right person, asking the right questions, but then it's very much about the production that happens afterwards as well.
So here's a question. Besides your small child, what gets you up in the morning? Like what's the thing that motivates
you? It's her every morning, yeah.
What motivates you then to get in the morning? Like, because there's obviously, there seems to be that there's lots of stories to be told, but what actually gets you excited?
I think it's just knowing when you're sitting on great content, really, getting excited about putting that together and sharing it with people. I think that's definitely, I mean, I spend a lot of my time doing admin, you know, sending emails and putting together sponsorship and advertising packages and stuff like that. And it's definitely just the actual craft of making the content that I enjoy the most. I mean, I've got another episode that's coming out very soon about the Clare Valley Screwcap Initiative, and those ones that involve a lot of different voices, a real craft in terms of how you arrange it all and soundtracking it with music and all that kind of stuff. That's the sort of stuff that I enjoy doing the most, I would say. But it's also the stuff that's just the most painstakingly difficult and time-consuming to do. Even when it is financially supported, I haven't yet got to a point where it makes financial sense for me to be making that content. It just doesn't. Like, it's something that you do because you enjoy doing it.
So thinking back now, is there something you would, if you had your time again, to sit there and go, right, I want to have my time again and start on day one, episode one, like what would you have done differently?
I probably would have started a couple of years earlier.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been sort of a few podcast experts recently that have said that the best way to start a successful podcast is to start it in 2016, because it was definitely a lot easier. I mean, I'm lucky I started it when I did. You know, I think in the second season, I got some pretty amazing promotion from Apple Podcasts, where they put Drinks Adventures on the front of Apple Podcasts and was there for like weeks, like even months. And over the years, all of the different bits of PR that I've had, all of the big names that I've had, all of the things that the awards that I've won, all of the things where you go, I'm going to make the big time now. You know, this is really going to take off. And it's just like, you know, they're just all little blips of kind of like you get a few new listeners here and there. Never anything. It's just all incremental. There's never any exponential growth. It's always just little things. I remember speaking to sort of one of my friends who's got a craft drinks brand, and he was saying, you know, that's just like, nothing's ever exponential. Like it's only ever just small incremental, you know, gains and one step forward, two steps back. Fortunately, not too much two steps back. But, you know, if I look back to then when Apple was still promoting independent podcasters, then I remember that was like pouring fuel on the fire in terms of the new listeners that I was getting back in. And I didn't really know how good I had at getting that promotion then. If I got that now, it would have been so much better, because I've got so many more episodes, I've got much better content. I would have had a much better chance of people staying on, I think, than I would have back then. Oh, look, I guess I could say that I would have got better gear, but I didn't really have any money to get better gear. These are things that were sort of out of my control. I think I'm pretty happy with the trajectory that it's followed. It's just been way harder than I thought it was going to be. One foot in front of the other at the moment, trying to kind of turn Drinks Adventures into a sustainable business. Like, that's what it's about, really. I feel like it's kind of at a point now where I'm actually getting that level of traction that I haven't had previously. I mean, the day that I launched back this year was like the biggest traffic day I've had by, like, as in it sort of probably doubled anything I've ever had before. So it's quite encouraging to see that.
When's the stubby holder coming there?
Stubby holder. Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to do cheap, shitty merch. I've got a you know, basket of those at home that brands have sent me over the years. So yeah. Plus, you should pour the beer into a glass. You know that.
Nice.